Commonwealth, Mr.
Bogie.
Bogie and Mr. Chandeville.
Yes, sir. Honorable police, is the court ready?
Whenever you'd like to proceed, and if you want to reserve any time for rebuttal.
Yes, sir. If I could reserve three minutes for rebuttal, I would appreciate it.
Yeah, you can't have 3 years.
No, sir. I understand. If it pleases the court, my name is William Bogie. I represent Joseph William Melisse in this appeal. And as the court is well aware through the briefings, that the issue surrounding the best evidence rule is what centers this appeal. As the court is well aware, the trial court allowed, over objection by the defense, a police officer to testify for as to text messages that purportedly were on the defendant's phone that were held in police custody for a period of some 10 months. The defense would submit that this was an abuse of discretion. The standard review in this type of case is an abuse of discretion because normally evidence is usually within the discretion of the trial court. However, in this case, as stated in the Commonwealth v. Wynn, the trial court has no discretion to admit clearly inadmissible evidence. None of the four exceptions to the best evidence rule had been met by the Commonwealth.
The best evidence rule isn't violated by the officer testifying that the phone pinged, was getting tons and tons of messages, correct?
No, sir.
So the trial court could consider that?
If the trial court deemed that to be relevant, yes, sir.
Okay.
Or the number of times the phone rang.
Yes, sir, but the number of times the phone rang was not testified to into this court, in this case.
But the number of, the fact that the phone was very hot, for lack of a better word, that he was receiving lots of messages, was in front of the trial court, in addition to the content.
The fact that it had been, that he had received several text messages was before the trial court, yes, sir.
Because the officer could hear that, right? He could hear the ping.
It was either pinging or vibrating. I don't think the testimony was as to what is something what happened. Yes, sir.
Well, he also testified that he had to know that because he read them all.
Yes, sir.
Even if all the best evidence rule could do would prevent him from saying what their content was, it couldn't stop him from saying they were a bunch of hits.
Yes, sir. That's correct.
Assuming for a moment that it's error.
Yes, sir.
We're under a non-constitutional harmless error standard. Given all of the other evidence that was in front of the trial court, why isn't the content of the messages harmless error under that lesser but still significant standard?
Well, Your Honor, as this court has stated, the harmless error analysis is not merely a sufficiency of the evidence standard. So the court doesn't simply add up all the other evidence and say, well, it doesn't the other evidence and then say, well, there was sufficient evidence to find the defendant guilty. And even if there is ample evidence to support a verdict, error is not harmless when the disputed testimony may well have affected the decision. So the issue is whether or not the evidence itself may well have affected the decision.
Let me ask you on that because, and correct me if I'm missing something here, but on page 35 of the appendix is where Mr. Phipps asked the question, what is the context that you specifically remember? What was the context of whatever text message did you personally observe on Mr. Melisse's cell phone? And the answer, I remember that several text messages were asking where he was at, asking if he was still in Manassas, still in the area of Manassas, if Mr. Melisse, if I'm pronouncing that right, could help him out with something. With something. No specifics. Asking him if he could help him out with something and things along those lines. So where he was, if he was still in Manassas or the area of Manassas, and if he could help him out with something.
Yes, sir.
No mention of drugs or any particular drug or any particular thing he needed to help him out with. Why isn't that just so general? And even that, the trial judge never referred to at all when she gave her reasons for the ruling. Why isn't that just harmless error?
Your Honor, the reason that it's not harmless error is the question is whether it could have affected the verdict. And the mere fact of an individual text messages that, without having the original text messages, so we're relying on a police officer's memory as to what they were said, the mere fact is, can you help me out with something, would tend to show, if the court believes the Commonwealth's theory of the case, that help me out with something means for the purposes of purchasing drugs. And as a result, the court, when it did its conclusion...
Something could mean, you know, just come and get me, or...
Sure, it could. That is correct.
It's just so general.
That is correct. It is general. But as this court is well aware, it is rare when drug transactions are taking place that an individual says, will you sell me some oxycodone? Usually generalities are used, and the trial court did in fact was aware of these generalities, and the trial court did in fact hear this generality in conjunction with the other evidence.
And if it's so general as to not give rise to a negative inference, then it's too general to have been admitted in the first place.
Yes, Your Honor, it would be irrelevant in that manner. I would say that as well.
So can you point us to where in the record that supports your claim on brief that the help him out with something could be and was interpreted to demonstrate impending narcotics transaction or transactions?
Well, when the Commonwealth argues that it is highly circumstantial, highly suspicious, along with the other evidence, I think the inference can be made that the court considered that when the court made its decision that there was sufficient evidence mentioning the phone ringing along with everything else. That is part of the everything else.
But
there is no
trial judge doesn't say that. On page 120, he talks about other things, you know, about the oxycodone at his cousin's house. But then she says, the fact that the amount of money on his person is precisely within $100 of what the street value of the missing drugs would be is significant, along with the constant phone ringing. That in and of itself wouldn't be something, but together with everything else. So she's talked about all these other things. I took that to be together with everything else, all these other things that she said in the previous lines of her statement of why she was finding guilty.
Well, we are, unfortunately, we're stuck with doing sort of a post hoc tea leaf reading as determining what was going through the mind of the trier of fact. And if the court has asked me whether specifically the trier of fact did mention the text messages, the answer is no, the court did not. But I think we can presume that an experienced trial judge would have heard all of the evidence that came in and would have considered the evidence that came in, and this evidence came in error.
The harmless error analysis isn't whether it potentially could have affected the trier of fact. It's whether we believe it did influence the trier of fact, is it not?
Well, I would suggest that the harmless error analysis is may well have affected. Only if the court determines... I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt.
But the Supreme Court in Anderson summarizes it this way. If we are, quote, sure that the error did not influence the fact finder or had but slight effect, the verdict and judgment should stand. So Anderson leaves open the possibility with non-constitutional harmless error that we can conclude that it might have played some role, but as long as it's minor enough that we think that the ultimate outcome wouldn't have been different, that it can still be harmless. So how do you argue that it doesn't fit within the Anderson framework I just read, which is Virginia Supreme Court 2011?
Well, I would argue that it does fit within the framework of Crawford v. Commonwealth 281 Virginia 84, where the court says...
Anderson is 282, so I got you.
Yes, sir. Yes, by one.
Like 6 months.
Yes, sir. But as the Crawford court said, that if the reasonable possibility whether evidence complained of might have contributed to the verdict, then the court must find that the error was not harmless. The burden is on the Commonwealth to show that the error was not harmless, not on the defense.
And of course, in Crawford...
Go ahead, sir.
Crawford, I'm thinking about, because it was appealed from this court, I think that should be the one, given the year you stated... Supreme Court found that it was harmless.
The court did, in fact, in that case, find it was harmless. If the court has no further questions, I will step. Thank you.
Mr. Chantevelle. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Chris Chantevelle for the Commonwealth. I think the most important question in this appeal that opposing counsel has failed to answer is a very basic question. It's a basic question of how. Namely, how could the contents of these text messages in any way substantially influence the outcome of this case? As Your Honor has noted, there is no objection to the testimony that Mr. Melisa's cell phone was constantly ringing and constantly receiving text messages and phone calls during the course of the stop.
Nor could there have been.
Nor could there have been, because there would have been no basis to object to that testimony. There was no actual change in the quantum of evidence against Mr. Melisa when the contents of those messages came in.
It was error to admit the content of the messages, though, wasn't it?
As I've argued in brief, I don't think that it was, for many of the same reasons. And this court's decision in Turner, I think, is a controlling case on that. I think it comes in under the collateral matters exception. In Turner, the evidence that...
I don't think Turner goes that far, and I have a little bit of insight into how far Turner goes.
Well, I would submit that question is before the court and still before the court and still an open question as to how far it goes. The evidence in Turner was evidence of the defendant's name and address being on mail in a basement along with drugs. And it was used at trial as circumstantial evidence that he had dominion and control over the drugs in the basement. I would submit that was fairly strong circumstantial evidence of his dominion and control over the drugs in that case. Yet the court still concluded that the actual contents of that mail, the name and the address on there, went to a collateral matter because it only helped to establish circumstantially that he had dominion and control over the basement and thus the drugs in the basement. This evidence does not go that far.
Isn't that, though, just because they were trying to show that that's his mail, just like other things of his that are in that basement. So therefore, it's really collateral to not what the mail says so much, although it's got to have his name on there to show that, but that regardless of what address it is on the mail, it's his mail. As opposed to perhaps here, where you really want to have a sense of what those messages are saying as related to the fact that for some reason within an hour of getting these prescriptions filled, most of the pills are no longer there.
Right. But I think in Turner, the court assumed, and the court stated in the opinion, assuming that his name on the mail is the only thing connecting him to this mail, and assuming that that qualifies under the best evidence rule, the court still concluded that it went to a collateral matter.
Isn't the Turner analogy better, though, if there was a question of whether the phone was his and all of the messages came into Joe? To me, that's the Turner analogy. You don't need anything after the Joe part, much as what was in the envelope in Turner, what was inside didn't matter. It was just his address established. So it wasn't the contents of what was inside the envelope. It was just the address, much as Joe would be. But here, that's not what the Commonwealth introduced. The Commonwealth introduced additional material, which clearly the Commonwealth believed gave rise to a negative inference. And in fact, argued that it gave rise to a negative inference, or else it wouldn't have come in.
No, the argument from the Commonwealth was that the contents of the messages was additional context that the trial court could consider. As the Commonwealth attorney argued, it would be up to the trial court, to determine whether or not there are any innocent explanations for those contents.
Well, right, but the possibility of a negative inference had to exist, or it wouldn't have been relevant for any purpose.
That's correct. And my argument as to harmlessness is that possibility of a negative inference is no greater than it was before the contents were admitted. When you have an individual receiving constant text messages and phone calls, you could draw a negative inference from the phone ringing constantly that perhaps someone's trying to buy drugs from him, but there may be an innocent explanation. It might be his son calling trying to get a ride home. By introducing the contents, that innocent or guilty, those two possibilities didn't change at all. Because the contents of the messages were so vague, can you help me out with something? That could have a guilty explanation. Can you help me out with some drugs? It could have an innocent explanation. Can you help me out? Can you give me a ride somewhere? So the actual weight of the evidence against Mr. Melisa was unchanged after the introduction of actual contents. It was the constant phone ringing that mattered most to the Commonwealth attorney, and which also mattered most to the trier of fact when the trial court announced its ruling and cited specifically the constant phone ringing, did not cite the contents of those messages. The only party that cited what the text messages actually said in argument on the record was the defense attorney. Defense attorney argued, look, there's possibly an innocent explanation for the contents of these messages.
Well, given the circumstances, and I saw that you made something of that in your brief, given that the Commonwealth has put them in, I think it's unfair to say, well, they somehow opened the door somehow by trying to explain them because, well, they've been put in. I've now got to explain them.
Right, and I'm not submitting that there's any negative inference against him to be drawn from him attempting to explain them. But in this court's harmless error jurisprudence, it is worth, one of the questions that the courts have asked is, how big of a role did this piece of evidence play in the trial court's ultimate conclusion, and how big a part of the Commonwealth's case was this piece of evidence? The contents of the messages themselves played a very minor role in the Commonwealth's case, and the trial court did not mention those contents at all. The only party that did was, again, defense counsel, thinking that he could argue that there was an innocent explanation. And I think that was an argument that he could make, and he did make, and the trial fact was entitled to decide, do I believe that there's an innocent explanation or not? And making that determination, the trier of fact looked at all the other overwhelming evidence of his guilt.
Under a non-constitutional harmless error analysis, is it enough to say, okay, if this particular evidence were excluded, if you subtract that out, this sort of an earlier today, if you were in here, non-asked arithmetic formula or arithmetic exercise of subtracting out everything that should not have been admitted or should have been suppressed or however you want to put it, and what's left is enough under non-constitutional harmless error analysis, is that a proper formula for saying it's harmless error?
I think that that is a proper way of stating the standard, and the courts have stated it in multiple different ways. And
it's not pure sufficiency, though. It's not enough, even under non-constitutional harmless error, to say the evidence would otherwise be sufficient.
Correct. And the court has stated that it's not pure sufficiency. But the courts have worded the standard in different ways. My opposing counsel has wisely, I guess, grasped onto the most favorable to him enunciation of the standard. But as Your Honor explained a moment ago, the Supreme Court has said the question is really whether the evidence that is inadmissible substantially influenced the outcome or whether it had but slight effect. And in this case, there's no indication on the record that this evidence had even slight effect, but certainly not more than slight effect.
So basically, your answer to my question is, it's not quite that simple. The but slight effect is the difference.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. And really what I think defense counsel is asking for this court to hold, and reading the standard the way that he is he's asking the court to hold that in order for a non-constitutional error to be harmless, the trial court basically has to state on the record, you know, what I did earlier may or may not have been error, but I'm not going to rely on that at all, so that it can be plain from the record that he didn't rely on it. And of course, trial courts are not required to make that sort of statement on the record. They're not required to say anything on the record.
Well, I'll ask it to you, but when Mr. Bogey gets up, I'll ask it to him, because it's really probably better directed to him. If we were to adopt the way Mr. Bogey has argued it, what would be the difference between constitutional harmless error review and non-constitutional harmless error review? Would there be any?
I don't think there would be any difference. And I think, honestly, the standard that he's asking for goes above and beyond even the constitutional harmless error standard. The standard there is whether the appellate court is convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that the error did not affect the outcome. I think what he's saying is that in order for the court to be convinced to that degree, the court needs to see some statement from the trial court on the record that this error I may have made earlier did not have any impact on my ultimate decision in the case. And that has never been the standard. I don't think it possibly can be the standard under either constitutional harmless error or non-constitutional harmless error, which of course is a lower standard. Finally, I noticed in opposing counsel's argument that there was an argument that the contents themselves were irrelevant, which I think, one, goes to the harmlessness of the contents. But secondly, by making that argument, I don't see how the contents can be anything but to collateral issues. If they're irrelevant, they must have been collateral. And perhaps a relevancy objection may have been successful at trial. That objection was not made. The only objection is the best evidence objection. And if the contents were irrelevant, then one, the error was harmless, and two, they went only to collateral matters, and thus there was no error. Unless the court has any further questions, I'm happy to rest on my brief and ask the court to affirm.
There appear to be none. Thank you, Mr. Shandovich.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Bogey, and I gave you the preview of the first question.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that the difference between is whether or not that the court would have to find in a constitutional harmless error analysis is whether or not the error was the error did not affect the outcome beyond a reasonable doubt. It sets a higher burden than not if it could have. And I think that there is a quantitative difference beyond in that situation because it places a higher burden on the Commonwealth. To correct something that the opposing counsel said, I did in fact object on relevancy grounds. That was on page 34. After the Commonwealth had argued that they're not asserting the matter for the truth, I said, well, then it's also irrelevant. I actually submitted a number of different grounds: authentication, relevance, best evidence, and hearsay. I would suggest that in answer to the Commonwealth's argument that how could the contents influence the outcome of the case, I think the court understands that it could have affected the outcome of the case because it would the contents themselves, without having been previously been provided to defense counsel and also without any other authentication or providing the original contents, would paint the defendant as that these are solicitations for purchasing drugs. And as the Commonwealth pointed out, I don't think the trial court has to say, well, I considered this, that was an error, but I didn't consider it in making my verdict. We're kind of doing it backwards. I mean, just because
the
court...
the trial judge is presumed to know the law.
That is correct. That is correct. And the trial judge is also presumed to have heard the evidence, and when it allowed evidence in error, the trial judge presumably considered that evidence that was an error when, in fact, it made its decision.
Considering and relying on it are two different things, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And on page 120, the trial judge talks for a while about what the trial judge relies on. And I read part of it earlier. I didn't want to read the whole page.
Yes, sir.
Take up your time. But why isn't that? Why don't we just rely on what was said there?
Well, as attorney for the Commonwealth has indicated, there is no requirement for the trial court to set the reasons
right.
Unless there's some statutory duty to do so.
But when the trial court does, then we look at it and consider. If the trial court said, oh, something was totally contrary to the law, then there's the argument we often get is, well, you see what the trial court said, and you've got evidence right there why you need to reverse.
If the evidence that was submitted in error, we have to presume that the trial court considered it. And even though the court did not enunciate it specifically, that it did in fact consider it,
isn't the question not whether the trial court considered it, but whether, given all of the other evidence and evidence that we know the trial court found important because the trial court said it found important, whether that's enough to swing it?
That I think the court is correct in that. I think that because this was entirely a circumstantial case without any direct evidence, it lends itself to the idea that that may have swung the court in the favor of the common law. Thank you.
Consistent with custom, we'll come down and greet counsel.